CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
Before we get started, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, we are brought that from CFO.com related to FASB accounting rules should rule private company accounting, the proposal said. And this article comes from David M. Katz. And it goes as follows. Launching itself into the teeth of a controversy, the Financial Accounting Foundation today proposed a structure for setting private company accounting rules that would position the Financial Accounting Standards Board as the ultimate standard setter, in the words of Teresa S. Poley, FAF President and Chief Executive Officer. The centerpiece of the plan is a new Private Company Standards Improvement Council, which will become known as PCSIC, that would identify, propose, and vote on exceptions or changes to U.S. Generally Accepted Accounting Principles aimed at private companies, according to a press release issued by the Board of Trustees of the FAF, a private sector body that oversees FASB and the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. Chaired by a member of FASB, the new council would comprise between 11 and 15 members, appointed by the FAF trustees and representing investors, lenders, auditors, accountants, and preparers of private company financial statements. The latter constituency could include CFOs, according to Poley. While the participants have not been named yet, FASB member Daryl F. Buck, who previously spent 18 years as CFO of Resource Holding Company, a private company with a $400 million in annual sales, seems clearly to be in the running for the chairmanship of the new council. In proposing that FASB should be the ultimate arbiter of private company reporting standards, the FAF trustees have put themselves squarely in opposition to a plan put forward 9 months ago by the Blue Ribbon Panel on standard setting for private companies, a group that counted Poley among its membership. Under the new FAF plan, changes approved by a two-thirds majority of the council would be forwarded to FASB for ratification. The changes would become final following public comment, further deliberation by the PCSIC, and then final ratification by FASB. So those are some of the new changes that are taking place, and we appreciate and would like to say thank you very much to our CFO.com contributor for that article. Well, today joining us, we are very pleased to have with us Jim McComb, who is Senior Executive in Finance, Marketing, and Strategic Planning for the Home Loans Division of Bank of America, a role he assumed nearly 3.5 years ago upon the bank's acquisition of his previous employer, Countrywide Financial Corporation. For 5 years, Jim was the Senior Vice President of Strategic Planning at Countrywide, then America's largest mortgage lender and servicer. His present responsibilities center around analysis of mortgage trends and financial performance in the bank's consumer direct mortgage business and advising senior management. Prior to joining Countrywide, Jim was Vice President of Marketing and Strategic Planning for West Corp, the nation's largest corporate credit union, and earlier he served as the managing director of an Oregon advertising agency as a senior level marketing management executive for several commercial banks and as a partner in the Center for Strategic Management, a global management consulting firm that is the world's largest strategic planning consulting. Jim was also Senior Vice President for Marketing and Strategic Planning at Community First Bankshares, America's largest community bank holding company in the 1990s. Well, with that, Jim has about 30 years of experience in business management. He holds a BS in finance with a minor in marketing from the Stokely School of Management at the University of Tennessee, and he graduated with a distinction from the American Bankers Association School Bank Marketing and Management. Well, with all that said, my goodness, Jim, that's a lot. That's quite an accomplishment. We're absolutely thrilled to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Well, Jim, let's start at the beginning. Let's get to the meat of who Jim is. What was your first position, whether it was a paper round or maybe a store clerk? What was your first position, whether paid or non-paid?
Well, I began my finance career very early, and just like in the movies, I started in the mail room. I was the mail boy at a suburban Chicago bank, and I spent every day going up and down stairs and elevators in a bank that was an entire city block and seven stories tall, and I got into every department of the bank every day, so it was a great learning experience. That was the first job.
So how did you get from there to today?
Well, one of the stops that I made every day in that bank was at the office of a gentleman by the name of Mr. Abegg. And Mr. Abegg was the chairman of the board. And I was just a 16-year-old kid at the time who didn't know a lot. And one day, Mr. Abegg's secretary was gone, so I stuck my head in his office and asked if he had any mail. And he said, "I don't believe I know you. Come on in and let's talk." And I asked him what a chairman of the board did, which now I'm kind of horrified to think back that I would ask somebody at that level a question like that. But he said, "You know, I'm not sure myself most days what that person does." But I just in that job began to literally learn everything there was to learn about banking and how what people did in offices on the fourth floor related to what they did on the second floor. And so I went to the University of Tennessee, which at the time was the only school in the country that had a major in banking, and completed that program, got out, became a management trainee at what was then U.S. National Bank of Oregon, and today is U.S. Bank, the fifth largest institution in the country. And upon getting out of the management training program, became a loan officer and then morphed into my real love, which was marketing VP. And I spent a number of years heading the marketing function at various commercial banks. And then the merger and acquisition situation hit me in the 80s and early 90s, and my employers were bought five times in the space of 10 years. And so I was on the move, and eventually my family said enough, so I became a management consultant with the Center for Strategic Management and specialized in financial institutions. So I still stayed close to the industry, but had what looked like a little more steady employment. And one thing led to another from there. I eventually got back into banking by virtue of the fact that my employer Countrywide was acquired by Bank of America. And so today I actually have a position I used to dream about when I was in the mailroom, and that was to be a senior level person at an extremely large bank, and have accomplished that today.
Well, that's fabulous. And I would like to say that from an outsider's perspective looking in, the charm with which you told your story about asking the chairman of the board what exactly the chairman of the board did, I think that talks very much to what I would describe as the innocence of maybe 25, 30 years ago that we did have. And just the innocence of somebody.
I'd probably never do that today.
Well, no, but also, you know, the interesting thing is the innocence that young people have, and the younger they are, the more innocent, and very candidly, they ask sometimes the questions that need to be asked. I would imagine that the board sometimes wanted to ask the chairman what the heck he did and maybe didn't have the courage. But that's fabulous. Well, Jim, you've been in strategic planning and as an executive as such for 25 years. You've reported to a number of CFOs over the years. This is a radio program where we interview and meet with CFOs. And the intent is to learn what makes them tick, what makes them good, what makes them effective strategic thinkers and leaders. And perhaps there's a particularly effective CFO that you've worked with. What was there about his or her management style and the skill set that they brought to the table that stands out in your mind?
Well, one person immediately comes to mind, and he does because he is my mentor even today. Even though we no longer work together, a gentleman by the name of Pete Kuchma, who I reported to at a Fortune 100 financial services company we both worked at some years back. And what has always impressed me about Pete is, in a lot of companies, the senior level executives are very siloed in what they do. The marketing person is at the table, and the IT person is at the table, and the finance person is at the table, and they're all very certainly experts in what they do, but they essentially come to that senior management suite representing their function rather than as one of the leaders of the company as a whole, and that always impressed me about Pete. He had a very deep and a very broad knowledge of the entire business, not just finance, and that enabled him to truly be one of the leaders of the business. And he had all the skills that, you know, great CEOs have. He was a problem solver, and you know, he had a high degree of has a high degree of integrity, a great communicator. And financial knowledge was second to none. Great work ethic, but he had a couple of other things too that really impressed me. One is he has a great amount of courage, personal courage. When you know, when there are things that are best for the business but aren't necessarily popular in the C-suite, Pete is one of those people who steps up and says, you know, this may not be the thing that's the most popular right now, but it is the right thing to do for our company if we truly are going to achieve our vision. And, you know, a lot of people just don't have that courage. It's easier, particularly if they get a signal from the CEO that he or she doesn't particularly share that opinion. It's easy to just go along to get along, but Pete had that courage. He also cares very deeply for people. Took time to develop people. Took an interest in what their career goals and objectives were. And a lot of times in finance, you know, we're all so busy. We've got deadlines, and there just oftentimes isn't a lot of time for people. But Pete always made time for people. And probably most important of all, he's a visionary. He's a strategic thinker. He's always many, many steps ahead of everyone else in terms of thinking about where the future's taking us and what we need to be doing today in order to make sure we get there. He's the complete package, in my opinion, and I feel very honored to have him as a mentor.
Fabulous. And let's say his name again. We're going to give another shout-out for Pete.
Okay, his name is Pete Kuchma. It's spelled K-U-C-M-A.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to see if we can try and get Mr. Pete on the radio show with us. And I think also one of the things that you pointed out there is something that perhaps is an underlying element of many of the successful people in this world are innovative on their own, and they force forwards because of the fact that they have that inner desire, knowledge, passion, and they go and get it. But there are as equally as many people in this world that need and want and have mentors, and some of them are formal, some of them are informal, but they can draw an awful lot of brilliance that they have and expertise in leadership onto the people around them. And it sounds as if Pete's done that for you.
Absolutely.
Well, which of a CFO's many roles do you feel is the most important? CFOs manage everything. We're considered to be bean counters, yet we manage controls functions, risk functions, strategic, whether it's treasury and cash flow, internal audit. Yes, we close the books and we do the financial reporting. Sometimes as a result of that, we're managing data systems and ERP platforms. Sometimes we also manage human resources functions outside of all the day-to-day AP, AR, transactional stuff. But which of those many roles do you feel is the most important and why? And in most organizations, do you feel that the roles that you're describing receives the emphasis that it needs? Essentially, are we going wrong as CFOs?
Sure. Well, having heard a bit about my background, you might be able to successfully predict here what I'm going to say. I feel the most important piece of a CFO's role today is their role as a strategist and a strategic thinker. And in many organizations, the strategic planning function reports to the CFO. And because of that, I think it's imperative that the CFO really take on that role as the chief strategist. Now, you know, for a long time, we've been told that's the CEO's role. But I think in most companies, the CFO truly is the strategist and the CEO is the leader, the source of inspiration for the staff, the one who maybe sets the general direction of the company, but really relies on the CFO because he or she is the person who truly has the keys to the kingdom, and that is information, financial information. And if the strategic planning function does report to them, they certainly have access to literally all of the management information in the company. And I think this is important because the strategy function adds depth to everything that the CFO does. The FP&A function, reporting and controlling functions, and you know, for years, I think a lot of us in finance, I know as I've progressed in various finance jobs over the years, it's always seemed like we were doing what we did because the regulators wanted it or because analysts on Wall Street wanted it. And we never really thought as much about, you know, what is the strategic direction of this company and where is the company going? And more importantly, why is it going there? Why did we choose that particular direction? And what does what we do every day in the finance department have to do with getting us there? So we don't just exist to satisfy analysts and regulators. Now, certainly we have to do that. I'm not suggesting that we don't. But that's not our only function. We're at the table, remember, as a leader of the entire company, not just a leader of finance. And,
so do you think that we as a general CFO pool of talent, do we hit the market on that? Do we hit the mark? I beg your pardon?
In some companies we do. In a lot of organizations, I don't think we do because that's not where the emphasis is put by the CEO. And in many cases, the CFO literally grew up in the finance function and is very numbers-oriented and isn't necessarily thinking about their role as strategy. I know the very first time I reported to a CFO as a strategic planning executive, that person wasn't quite sure what to do with me because I was a new experience for him. And it didn't mean he wasn't an effective CFO, didn't mean he wasn't very knowledgeable and very good at what he did, but I was a wild card that he wasn't quite sure what to do with because he hadn't had experience with the strategic planning function in the past. And so I think it's better now than it was certainly several years ago. but we still got a ways to go in implementing that strategy function as really a key piece of what the CFO does in many organizations.
I hear you. And in that regard, very often the challenge of the CFO is it's a multifaceted role, which I believe is one of the few roles in a company where we not only look in the rearview mirror and have a substantial element of investment of personnel time doing just that, but we're also looking at the forward-looking component. We're looking at next year, 5 years, and maybe beyond that, 10 years. And so we're one of the few people in the company that has to be able to balance all the aspects of past and history, data, comparisons, and then what does that drive, if you will, in terms of pattern, behavior, trends, and so forth, not only for our company, but our customers and vendor pricing and inventory management and so forth into that future role. It's a very complex role.
I think the CFO really has the most difficult role in the company. Because there are so many different things really that converge into that function. And I just feel if there were a most valuable player in the C-suite, it certainly would be the CFO.
Well, that's a great shout out, certainly, for the CFOs that are out there that are working hard and sometimes don't maybe get the praise within the companies that they may need. But let's talk a little bit about today. We've talked about the role of the CFO being the past and also that of the future. Well, today the world still has a lot of uncertainty. We are in the United States coming out of a recession. Some CFOs in recent polls and surveys have said that they believe we're entering into a double dip. Other CFOs have said that they're not sure that we've even emerged from the previous one. And yet some CFOs with their companies are having double-digit growth and life is good. But we're still in a recession and worldwide there are still a lot of shock effects of the U.S. economy. In that regard, the role of the chief strategist must be one of the most difficult roles to play in the organization. And we've talked a little bit about the chief financial officer having that role as chief strategist. How do you feel about that combination of CFO and chief strategist and with the backdrop of an uncertain economy, how does that chief strategist CFO play the role?
Well, first of all, I think it's a natural marriage because when you think about what the finance function has historically done, forecasting, projecting, budgeting, they're attempting to predict the future financially for the company. And the chief strategist takes that role one step further and says, okay, in addition to the financial performance of the company, we're now going to take a look at all of our strategic objectives for getting to whatever vision of the future our management team has chosen to draw up. And by having the strategic planning function report to the CFO, it now, I think, completes the picture. So they're not only forecasting the financial future, but they're now in a role where using scenario planning and some other tools, they can forecast the future of the company. And, you know, nowadays, when we reflect back on things like 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina and the financial meltdown and all of these watershed events that have occurred in the last 10 years, there's a lot of hand-wringing going on at various companies, like, oh, no, what's the next big surprise that's going to hit us, and what's that going to do to our industry and our customers and our company? And unfortunately, we look at those events, and I should back up and say I've been to some financial conferences where they talk about, you know, the new era of uncertainty that we're entering because of these events that I mentioned and several others. And, you know, in my opinion, life's always been uncertain. None of us has ever been able to predict the future. You know, there's a few people who show up who claim to be able to do that, but But really, we've never been able to fully anticipate any of the things that were gonna happen to us or the impact. And so, I think by marrying those two roles, what we are creating is a function in the company that does at least have the ability to insulate the company from that uncertainty if they use the right tools. And maybe we'll talk about some of those today, I'm not sure. But if they use the right tools, there are ways to manage in spite of uncertainty and be successful.
Let's talk a little bit about those tools. I think that is something that our listeners would like to dig into. Are you referring to any specific elements of tools?
Well, one organization that I'm involved with here in Los Angeles is called the Executive Next Practices Institute. And essentially what that is a think tank for executives from a broad cross-section of industries. I mean, it's not a company. It's a place, essentially, where executives, C-level executives, come together and talk about emerging trends in a number of areas, technology, regulation, changing face of the customer, the economy, certainly, competitive environment. They talk about the emerging trends that are showing themselves in each of these areas, and then meet in very small groups to incubate new ideas that essentially will leverage the opportunity that's in those trends and will mitigate the challenges that are in those trends before the trends ever fully develop and manifest themselves in a business environment. And we call those next practices simply because best practices, which everyone is using now, are things that were developed and then shared over a broad cross-section of people. So you now have many people using the same best practices, and it's still difficult for any company in any industry to truly break out and be the unique force in that industry that they need to be in order to truly make an impact on the customer. And so that's why we think next practices are so valuable, and I think those are the tools. And a next practice essentially is something that fundamentally transforms the way you do business, and it makes you unique in your space, which is critical, because obviously if you're unique in your space, it costs you a lot less money to build market share than it does when you're in a space and you're just one of the vanilla brands that's out there. And I'm not sure if I answered the question.
I think you did, and I think you're also alluding to not only best practices, but also elements of what I would describe as systems, how to follow up with certain elements of data, all those different elements of how do we start with what the finance function needs and how do we draw upon that?
Well, a CFO, and we have many CFOs who are involved in the Institute, but a CFO could develop next practices around things like shortening cycle time, increasing efficiency, developing new management reporting tools to essentially address decision-making deficiencies that may exist in the organization. New forecasting or budgeting techniques. There are really a number of possibilities out there, and as you might have guessed, I do have some thoughts on what a CFO can do to essentially break away from the pack relative to next practices. But when you think about what the priorities of most businesses are today, they're talking about things like customer service, customer satisfaction, revenue growth, maintaining closer relationships with the customers now that there's social media outlets and similar types of avenues like that, keeping finance more closely connected to customer needs. And you know, in a lot of those priorities, you've got the same central theme popping up over and over and over, and that is the customer. And what is a customer? Well, a person, obviously, a person who thinks, and more important than that, a person who changes their thoughts every now and then. And because we don't home in on that as much, when we do forecasting, there are a lot of organizations that still today, in spite of all the sophisticated software we have and all of the sophisticated education, you know, that finance people are getting at our institutions of higher learning today, in spite of all that, we still have companies that struggle with getting forecasts on target. And they do because there are lots of elements that are missing. And, you know, if you think about what how a forecast is defined, you know, in a very basic sense, we think of it as a planning tool that helps management in its attempts to cope with the uncertainty of the future, uncertainty we mentioned earlier. And yet, if you stop and think about how most forecasts are done, they rely mainly on data from the past and on the present, and they analyze trends based on that information from the past and the present. And, you know, as you and I, and I'm sure all of your listeners know, what happened in the past and what's happening today isn't necessarily easy to extrapolate into what's going to happen for sure tomorrow. And, you know, that's one of the biggest problems we have with forecasting, you know, being so difficult.
And the challenge with forecasting is that if each of us could bring more certainty to the economy, to the path that we're on, it certainly forecasting would be an awful lot easier, but it is the largest challenge. And one of the aspects that I've found in my experience is that very often, if the forecast doesn't come to bear, depending on the company's culture, the organization may look to the chief financial officer and the finance function for, quote unquote, getting it wrong, rather than perhaps looking at the individuals that provided the information that said, you know, I'm going to go sell X million or X tens of million, and the person that said, I'm going to maintain costs at X amount. And I think also the scenario of companies that do what-if scenario budgeting seem to be able to have a more finely tuned ability to what I would describe as turn the Titanic. If certainly there's nothing else that we've learned from the last 3 or 4 years here in the US, many companies that perhaps were in that small to medium size range stopped looking at forecasts and budgeting, and they stopped doing that monthly forecast because they couldn't control it. They didn't know what was happening. And sometimes this was because in an unexpected manner, companies did grow during the recession, but for the most part, they were hit.
Well, I'm going to say something here that many people in the audience might not necessarily agree with when they first hear it. So I guess I ask you to think about it a little bit. And that is, I think where a lot of forecasts miss the mark is we spend a lot of time trying to predict what the economy is going to do, what the market is going to do, what our industry is going to do. And the forecasts don't spend enough time focusing on what is it that the company wants to do. And I firmly believe that if we started forecasting based on vision of the future rather than on what we thought the economy was going to do, we'd be on target a lot more times. And, you know, history is full of examples of being able to be profitable, being able to have revenue growth, being able to be successful even when times are bad. Out here in Los Angeles, one of our major industries is entertainment. And when you think about the greatest year, most movie buffs will tell you the greatest year in the history of motion pictures was 1939.
Okay, I've got to ask, what movies came out in 1939? I don't remember that far back.
Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz, and a movie called Stagecoach, which was the very first film that featured a young actor by the name of John Wayne. But in spite of what movies came out that year, the big thing was the movie business was very, very successful in 1939. And if, you know, those maybe who do remember back then might remember that we still weren't out of the Depression. There was a lot of uncertainty in the world because in 1939, Hitler was invading Poland and there was a lot of tension and, you know, uncertainty about, gee, are we on the brink of another war? We're still not out of this economic mess. And we were in a period of time that in a lot of ways looks like where we are today. The economic uncertainty, the uncertainty around the security of the world and that sort of thing. Yet, here's an industry, and the reason I hold up movies is because it's an industry that a lot of us would think, well, gee, in economic tough times, that industry is probably going to have trouble because most of us will say, gee, I need to pay the mortgage, I need to buy groceries, I need to pay the electric bill this month. I can probably forget going to the movies. Yet, people didn't, because the industry was able to position motion picture entertainment as a diversion from all of those troubles and uncertainties that people were thinking about, and they were able to get people into the theaters to buy tickets. And I think that same thing is possible today. And I think if a lot of management teams would think less about, oh my God, what's the market going to do tomorrow, and oh my God, what's the economy going to do to us, and would focus instead on what does this company want to accomplish and how can we get there in spite of all the noise that's out in the marketplace. Look at what Mark Zuckerberg did with Facebook. The guy's a billionaire now. He's 26 years old, and he did it essentially while the financial meltdown was occurring. It's possible for any of us if we just use the right tools. And
I think that's a wonderful series of words of wisdom. And certainly in terms of as we go forward, there are an awful lot of companies that are achieving significant high growth. And it isn't necessarily those that you would even think. Certainly in the retail industry, there have been significant slumps, but in the world of women and fashion, one of the elements that always occurs in a recession is that lipstick sales go up. Women may not buy a $300-$500 dress, but a $5-$15 lipstick is something that can make them feel good. And certainly I've been made aware of some of the retail sales that have been in decline, but some have been in increase. In the same regard, high-end car purchases have a different inflection in terms of a high economy versus a low economy. So some elements of that forecasting translates to people just being good leaders. They say in the entrepreneurial world that good leaders don't care about the rest of the world. They just forge on. And that's the difference between a good entrepreneur, is that he or she doesn't get bogged down by what may be happening worldwide, they really don't care sometimes. They're in their own world. The 26-year-old you just mentioned, he really didn't care. He just went out and did it, and my goodness, he's now reaping the benefits. I don't think he's quite on a beach. I think he's still managing the business from within, is my understanding.
He is, although he doesn't have to be. He's there because he has passion for the business. And certainly a leader we lost a couple days ago, Steve Jobs, fits that same mold. I mean, he has created, and again, during, you know, a lot of Apple's greatest success has come in the years since we first began to experience our meltdown back in, well, probably early 2007, late 2006 is really when this started. And yet he's created this legion of followers who will stand in line, who will pay higher prices to get a brand that they're essentially hooked on. And he's created a suite of products, and probably his greatest success, and this is something that I share in speeches I give quite often, when you think about it, iTunes should be run by one of the record companies, not by a computer company.
Essentially, they took over the record business.
Yeah, they took over the music. You know, where's Capitol Records? Where's Warner Music? Where are all of the leaders in that industry when it comes to what is now the largest retailer of music? And they mentioned that among the tributes to Steve Jobs within the last couple days, that iTunes is now the largest retailer of music in the entire world, and they've never produced a single album. They've never managed the career of a single artist. They've never really had much of anything to do with the music business other than providing a vehicle on which to play music.
And I think also one of the things that Apple has done is that they specifically targeted the younger, more entrepreneurial, more creative individual. Not to, you know, make broad mass generalizations, although I just did, but in certainly listening to the you know, people on the internet that have given an honor of saying, you know, Steve Jobs impacted my life in this way and in this way. There's an awful lot of people that really are very, very young that are in that mix. And I think that they've targeted, Apple has targeted a very unique subset of the universe. And I think it was the older people that were the second stage that said, hey, what's all this iPhone? What's all this iPad? What's, you know, what are all these things that I need to learn about, my kids telling me about?
Well, some of us have become believers, though. I'm 57 years old, and I'm toting a tablet around.
There you go. There you go.
It goes everywhere with me.
Well, one could argue maybe Apple has one of the best CFOs in the world. Let's see if we can give out a shout for the CFO. I'm sure that it really is a substantial leadership team. And in fact, talking of substantial leadership teams, and we've talked a little bit about what you describe as next practices. What specific types of next practices might a CFO develop? Could you take us down to that next granular level of detail?
Sure. I notice we're starting to run short of time here, so I think I want to focus on one in particular that I really believe is critical, and that is forecasting. You know, we've mentioned forecasting several times this morning, and I want to make sure that maybe we follow through in that vein. Forecasts up to now, a lot of the problems they've had is that they don't necessarily lead to realization of organizational goals. They often have, you know, as I mentioned, the agenda of satisfying the regulators or Wall Street, and sometimes they're based on key performance indicators that aren't necessarily consistent across the organization. You have maybe your sales staff being incented by one set of KPIs, and you have the performance. performance of the executive team being judged based on another set of KPIs, and it really kind of lacks the focus there. We don't always consider all of the risks that are involved in the future. Oftentimes we're looking at financial risks, but we forget about things like strategic risk and reputational risk, which can be just as critical to the future of our company. Our forecasts oftentimes are calendar-driven, Q1, Q2, 2011, 2012, rather than being event-driven. They don't necessarily prepare us for the future. Sometimes they do more reliving of the past. But probably the biggest thing I think that forecasts are missing today, and here's the opportunity for the next practice, is they don't include what I call the silver bullet. And the silver bullet is in knitting that into your forecasting process is, I think, vital to becoming that unique force in the marketplace that we were talking about earlier. And so as we lead up to the silver bullet, let's think about something else first. What's the single most important thing that any organization on the face of the planet does?
I'll let you answer that.
I don't want to
get it wrong.
Well, it's value. Something you provide to customers and prospects who want it, who are willing to pay for it, and who recognize that you and you alone deliver it. You know, we oftentimes get so caught up in selling products and services, we forget that people don't buy products and services. They buy value that solves problems in their life, that makes their life easier, more convenient, more fun. But that's what they're buying, is value. And a lot of times forecasts miss the mark because there's a disconnect between what we forecasted and the value that we're trying to deliver. And so you repair that disconnect with the silver bullet. So what is the silver bullet? And, you know, in all of what we've talked about today, if the audience takes away nothing else, I hope they take away this point. And that is the most important thing, the thing that drives all of change in American business, is this. It's the residual impact of the movement of stakeholder thoughts on your organization's success drivers relative to the value you create, produce, and deliver. Now, that's a big mouthful, and people are probably out there going, what did he say? So I'm going to read it again, but I'm going to start at the end and work backwards, because I think it's a little bit easier to see how what we're really talking about here if I do that. Okay, so we start with the value we were just talking about, the value you create, produce, and deliver, okay? Then think about your organization's success drivers. And frankly, organizations define success in a lot of ways, but the way they really need to define it is in terms of, did we create, produce, and deliver the value that people want? Now, that's not rocket science. It's a principle that a lot of businesses have been operating under for years. We know we create value. We define success based on whether or not we create, produce, and deliver that value. But here's the new thing that, in fact, is the next practice, and that is that for years we've been surveying customers and we've been asking them, you know, are you satisfied? What do you think of our products and services? And we don't realize that what we're asking them to tell us are their feelings based on things they've already done, products they've already used, and feelings about where they are today, what they're thinking about today. And the silver bullet for companies is the other part of this definition. It's all about predicting what they're going to think tomorrow. And so just simply by stopping with customer satisfaction questions, we're not going far enough, because what we want to track is the other part of this definition, and that's the movement of stakeholder thoughts. We want to be able to trace over time how people's thought patterns are changing and how that impacts the decisions they make in their life, which of course include whether or not they buy our product. And so what we need to knit into the forecast is the impact of those changing thoughts on our success drivers as we seek to create value. And that's something that's missing from virtually every forecast in America today, because we aren't thinking about what people are going to think of our product a year from now. And we mentioned Steve Jobs a minute ago. That is why Apple is so wildly successful today, because when they do focus groups and when they talk to customers and prospects, it isn't just, gee, how do you like your iPhone? They ask people questions about their lifestyle, about how they live their lives, about how that lifestyle is changing. They ask people about their thought patterns on a variety of different things, not just Apple products, not just technology, but how they live their lives. And then over time, they track how those thought patterns are changing so they can then see a direction. And that is why they own the music business today, because they were making those kinds of predictions about where people were going, how people wanted to consume music in the future, how they wanted their music delivered to them in the future, when and where and how they were going to listen to music in the future.
And I think
they
one of the things...
They were asking the right questions.
Yeah, I think one of the elements that I would say from my seat of Apple is that very much they have been able to maintain something that most other firms, as they grow, do not. Apple seems to be an entrepreneurial conglomerate. And most companies, when they go from entrepreneurial to starting to be one of size, policies, procedures take into play, and hierarchy and structure and people's roles and titles and all those kinds of things seem more important than satisfying the customer. And I think Apple has been very, very successful in focusing on the customer in all aspects of what it does. I recently read a report that said that Microsoft and Bill Gates, Melinda Gates was asked about the Apple iPad, and she said, well, we're not allowed to have any Apple products in our house, but I'm very curious about it. And I hope I'm quoting correctly. That is somewhat of a secondhand quote. But, even the larger conglomerates, they seem to let structure take over from the entrepreneurial innovation that Apple seems to have been so successful. And it's interesting that you point out that it is a customer-oriented focus and future need for what they're looking for in the marketplace that has driven that success. And that obviously is why forecasting is so difficult. Maybe the forecasting function needs to have a market research arm to it, bigger than
absolutely.
Really it does.
The CFO should be joined at the hip with the chief marketing officer, because market research is critical to the forecasting function. It's not thought of that way in a lot of companies, but it's critical. And again, when you think about those questions we were talking about a few minutes ago, if you stop and think what drives human behavior, it's our core values. They determine everything that we do in our daily lives, and the things that that grow out of those core values are things like our vision of the future and what we're afraid of, what keeps us awake at night, what and who we aspire to be in the future. And those kinds of things are what determines what we buy and how we live our lives. And the other piece of this is confidence. You know, when you think about the drivers of the American economy, there are really only two. You know, we talk about all the leading economic indicators and all that, but what really drives the economy is two things: consumer confidence and investor confidence. If consumers aren't confident about the future, they're not going to buy products. And if investors aren't confident about a company, they're not going to invest in the stock. And it doesn't get any more fundamental than that. So, you know, the other piece, I guess, to, you know, the CFO being the chief strategy officer is he or she has to figure out a way not just to tap into these thoughts and feelings and how they're changing, but also how do we make people more confident about our future as a company, about the future of our industry, the viability of the value that we're offering people.
And with that, Jim, we are pushing time, so I'd like to skip to the end. And we have a tradition on our show to ask our guests a specific question regarding their CFO tip of the month. What is your CFO tip of the month?
Well, it's based on my favorite quote, and it's words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, and he once said, "Do not follow where the path may lead. Go instead where there is no path and leave a trail." And I would say to every CFO listening, that is what makes business leaders great, when they don't follow the path, but they create the path instead. And the best way to do that is actually through the words of another great American named Florence Nightingale, who once said, "Why do we exist if not to make life better for others?" So I would say, if every time the management team at your company convenes, if the first question on the agenda is, "How can we make somebody's life better today?" your company has nothing to worry about in an uncertain world.
Well, that is a fabulous tip and some really great quotes. Thank you very much. Jim McComb, our guest for today, thank you so much for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. It's been a great pleasure having you on the radio.
Thanks, Lorraine. Pleasure to be here.
And thanks also go to our contributor, CFO.com, for the news article earlier, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs, controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, please go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks also to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website can be found at financialexecutives.org. And last but not least, National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know a CFO that would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us by the link on the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.